Good morning, everyone. We're going ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today we have a number of bills for public hearing and possible work sessions. What I'm going to do, I see Senator Roblin's here. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2226A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, this passed the House floor unanimously and out of committee with 8 ayes and 1 excuse vote. This comes from Rep. Hoyle and Rep. Gilliam and is the work of the Oregon Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. What this bill does is develops a right of restitution for an estate of a victim. Should the victim die, the estate can now recover under the victim restitution statutes through this bill.
Okay. Senator Roblin, why don't you come up first? And Cheryl, I see you're here as well. Why don't you go ahead and come on up and we'll go ahead and get your testimony as well.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and the Judiciary Committee. My name is Arnie Roblin. I am Senate District 5 Senator. I am here as a member of the task force, the Elder Abuse Task Force. This particular bill was not one that we originally had designed, but one that came to us, the concept. And because of that, we unanimously as a group decided this was something that was important. It has to do with a court case that took place in the Court of Appeals held in State versus Patton that the estate was not a person and therefore could not get restitution in the case of an elder abuse situation. So say that there had been a fraud taken up against the elder person who, involved a lot of money or other kinds of things, there was no restitution to the estate. So all this really does is make it clear that if a person were to die during the investigation and the investigation finally found out, came to a conclusion that restitution was required, it goes to the estate, and therefore the members of that estate, the trust, would have the right to collect the amount of resources that the courts had decided went to that person because of the elder abuse case. That's a simple bill, really a good idea. I think it was just an oversight and a court decision that created the need to have this bill brought to us. When the Elder Abuse Task Force heard it, it was clear that everybody realized that it was a problem and it needed to be rectified. So it's here to you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Roblin, can you stay by
sure.
And take the rest of the testimony, or do you need to take off?
And just I have a meeting going on, but I can wait for a little while.
Well, let me just ask, does anyone have any questions for Senator Roblin? Arnie, you're free to leave.
Okay, thanks. I will get to my other committee.
All right, thank you. Cheryl, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony? I have a question. I think you're probably going to be more apt to be able to answer that.
Sure. Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra, Oregon Department of Justice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General here today on House Bill 2226. As the good senator mentioned, this is a fairly technical fix. In State v. Patton, there was a granddaughter had been stealing from him between the time for sentencing and the conviction. The grandfather had died between the time for sentencing and the time for conviction, and the court found that since the estate was the only vehicle left to pay restitution to, and estates are not under the statute, that the court couldn't order the restitution to the estate of the victim. So this just fixes that hole. We ran it by several trust and estates attorneys, the language, and just to make sure we had all the bases covered. So if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay. I have one question. I just want to put this on the record as to I'm not sure what the answer is, but make sure it's covered. By giving the estate victim status, what, if any, impact will it have on victims' rights? Specifically, will the estate be able to exercise victims' rights as we know in the court proceedings, et cetera?
Chair Przanski, the estate will be able to exercise victims' rights as a result of this change. It changes the definition of a victim to include estates for the purposes of restitution, and that is covered by victims' estates.
Right. But if it's limited for restitution only, that's one thing. I just want to make certain, because I would have a little bit more pause if there is another right in the sense of just the constitutional rights that are protected of victims, in the sense of would we need, as prosecutors have, to give notice to the estate regarding any type of actions that are ongoing. Now, I would assume that, you know, the family members of a deceased individual are going to more than likely be in that victim status. But I am just wanting to make certain. So if we don't know that, we're going to look that up just to make certain. Because the way I read the summary, it looks like it is for restitution purposes only. And if that's the case, then to me it's clear sailing. If not, then we just need to make certain we know what we're doing before we actually complete it. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2226A? Not seeing anyone close that public hearing. We're going to go back to the top of the agenda and start at the top. So I'm opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 190.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 190 comes to you from the Attorney General's office. It is not ready to move today. We're still waiting for impact statements. This measure prohibits the shipment or transportation of cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, or smokeless tobacco products to anyone within the state unless they are a distributor or a retailer. It requires face-to-face transactions for retail sales of all tobacco products, and it gives a civil action enforcement authority to the Attorney General. You have two amendments today. The proposed -1 amendments come from DOJ and clarify that the prohibition on shipment or transportation is limited to those engaged in the business of selling tobacco products, and it narrows the focus to products purchased or ordered through mail, computer network, telephone network, or other electronic networks. And the proposed -2 amendments remove electronic cigarettes from the measure.
Okay, so looking at our roster of registered witnesses, I see Lisa. Is it? Boy, I can't read the last of it. I'm done. Unlon.
Udland.
Good morning. If you'll help me out with your last name, because I can't.
Yes, my name is Lisa Udland.
Udland, thank you. And Lisa, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, please?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Udland. I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice to testify in support of the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 190. I have over 10 years of experience in regulating, enforcing, and litigating tobacco-related issues, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about some of the problems we've seen over the past 10 years. We've seen a proliferation of websites selling tobacco products. Many times these are from foreign countries. In fact, we've been able to purchase cigarettes from Moldova, Russia, Israel. These products do not follow the laws of the state of Oregon or the federal government. Oftentimes, the products are sold without warning labels, without providing ingredient lists to the FTC and many other federal rules. Products that are sold over the internet often do not follow prohibitions on sales to minors. The internet offers relatively easy access to minors. Minors can get around age verification. Oftentimes, the age verification is simply click a button and say that you're over 18. And it's very difficult for sellers to ensure that folks purchasing cigarettes are actually over the age of 18. These cigarettes also often avoid paying taxes in Oregon. The state is losing revenue. These cigarettes are sold at huge discounts. This hurts legitimate Oregon businesses and thwarts the purpose of the excise tax. Excise tax makes cigarette products less attractive to minors, and allowing these sales to occur over the internet thwarts that purpose. In addition, cigarettes sold over the internet often do not follow the fire safe cigarette rules. In Oregon, since 2007, all cigarettes sold in Oregon must comply with reduced ignition propensity laws. In other words, they must be fire safe. Many internet sales do not meet these standards. Lastly, in Oregon, the Department of Justice publishes and maintains a directory of cigarettes and smokeless products that are approved for sale in Oregon. We review these products to ensure that they comply with federal and state laws and they are manufactured in an appropriate manner. Many of the cigarette sales we are seeing over the internet are not actually approved for sale in Oregon, and so this law would assist us in enforcing those requirements. So how does Senate Bill 190 address these problems? It restricts shipments and transports of cigarettes and e-cigarettes and smokeless tobacco products to licensed distributors. Those are distributors in Oregon who have gone through the Department of Revenue to obtain their license and who we know will pay the tax that is due. It prohibits retailers from selling products unless they do so as part of a face-to-face transaction. This way we can ensure the products are not sold to minors because you can do a minor check at the place of sale. This law will ensure that these cigarettes sold over the internet, or the cigarettes sold in Oregon, are only fire safe compliant, and it will allow the Attorney General's office to investigate and bring action against internet sellers who do not comply with our law. In conclusion, Senate Bill 190 is an important tobacco legislation that will assist with regulating sales of tobacco in Oregon, including limiting minor access and ensuring that products sold are compliant with state laws, including fire safe standards, and that these cigarettes have paid the tax. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about this measure.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Don't think so. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So it looks like we have a number of people who want to also speak on this. And I'm going to call up two panels. I'm looking to see if I got everyone together here. So Tim Churchill, Matt Manahan, and James Wright, if you three would come up first.
Good morning, Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Matt Minahan. I reside at 1989 Michelob Street, Salem 97304. And I'm the lobbyist for the Northwest Vapor Association. We're here today to discuss our opposition to Senate Bill 190 and in favor of the Dash 2 amendments that's before you today. Regulating the internet has been difficult at best, if not impossible. There are thousands of online retailers, and internet sales as it relates to the vaping industry, there are three kinds. There are Oregon businesses that are domiciled in Oregon, businesses that are domiciled outside of Oregon but still in the United States, and then businesses that are domiciled outside of the country, mostly as it relates to this industry, would be China. Should the Attorney General's office even be made aware of any internet sales, it would be much easier for them to bring civil action against an Oregon-based company and levy any assets they have, and much harder for a business out of state, and nearly impossible, in my opinion, for businesses that are out of the country, such as China. Legitimate business owners from Northwest Vapor Association based here in Oregon will adhere to the law should it pass, and many of the companies outside of Oregon may not even be aware of the law. So you'll be seeing a lot of sales from those businesses in Oregon via the internet. In my view, Senate Bill 190 does little to prevent vaping products to be sold to individuals, and it will create an unlevel playing field and kind of open up the market to those businesses that are unaware of the law, or maybe even bad characters that are aware of it and disregard it because the internet is so highly unregulated. And the vaping industry is a fairly new industry. It's very new to lawmakers. I understand that. We want to make a clear distinction of the difference between vaping and smoking and tobacco products. We understand what you're trying to do. The industry is not targeting minors, never has targeted minors. The flavors that it uses is not intended to target minors. We target smokers, people who have been smoking for 20-plus years who you're here from today. And I encourage you to ask them what flavor they vape when they testify. I don't think it'll do much for their manlyhood, but I think you'll find out that flavors, it'll show you that flavors are not targeting children. And it's used to get people off of smoking. A lot of people don't like the taste of smoke. They don't like cigarette butts. Vaping products has been the only product that's been successful in getting people to stop smoking, start vaping. And it's a product that actually reduces. You can control the nicotine levels. Cigarettes have over 400 carcinogens in them. There are four products used to make a vaping product. And if you look at the studies, we understand a lot of these studies are inconclusive. However, you'll see all of them, or most of them, if not all of them, will tell you that vaping is much healthier than smoking. And they go in front of doctors. I think many doctors would say if one of their patients came to them and said, "Doc, should I be smoking or vaping?" they would choose vaping over smoking. That's this industry's target. Online sales are a significant portion for the organ manufacturers, which you'll hear from today. We understand the importance of proper internet sales and the attempt to regulate that. We just feel Senate Bill 190 is not the proper remedy. NUVA members would be happy to discuss with the committee ways we can ensure that we're not selling to minors, age verification. But again, the vaping industry has immense potential to end smoking by creating a much healthier alternative. We think Senate Bill 190 will create an unlevel playing field. It will, again, be much easier to levy fines and regulation on an Oregon-based business. So you'll see internet customers still using the internet. They just won't be buying them from Oregon-based businesses, and it'll cost Oregon jobs. It'll stop expansion plans. And so what the Dash 2 does, we understand smokeless tobacco and cigarettes, and it sounds like maybe this bill was targeted to that. And vaping is certainly not to be wrapped into that category. So the another point is we're not taxed currently, so it wouldn't matter. You wouldn't be losing any tax, or the tax issue is kind of off the table when it comes to vaping since it's not really taxed. So given the separation of smoking versus vaping, we ask that the electronic cigarette portion of this bill be taken out, and that's what the Dash 2 does. So, you know, Northwest Vapor Association urges you to vote in favor of the Dash 2 amendment. I'm available for any questions that you might have.
All right, thank you. We're going to take the rest of the testimony and then open up for questions. So, Tim or James, who'd like to go next?
Good morning, Chair Przewski and committee. My name is Tim Churchill from Medford, Oregon. I'm representing EC Blend, who is in the top five largest employers of Jackson County. I drove all the way up from Medford this morning to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
We are actually in opposition to the SB 190, but we feel that the Dash 2 amendment would be the best. We currently, at EC Blend, we currently have over 120 employees, and with the business projections and plans for growth we have over the next two years, we would be adding over 200 employees. As you can see, most of our business is done over the internet, more than 80% through Oregon and through the United States, as well as 14 international countries. So you can see that this is a great concern to us to restrict the internet sales. We feel that there would be other ways possibly to monitor selling to individuals, to minors under 18, which we have a company policy not to sell to minors. We have for 3 years. This bill, SB 190, will kill hundreds of jobs, in my opinion, in Oregon, and will not stop internet sales from other states or from overseas countries. And in fact, possibly would force e-liquid business, e-cigarette business out of Oregon or to close. This product, in my opinion, has huge harm reduction possibilities. As myself, a smoker of 30 years, I've been able to quit for a year and a half now without one cigarette. I can't tell you how much better I feel, and is the reason that I started working with EC Blend. Please do not overregulate this industry. It's not tobacco, and we really do not want to be associated with tobacco. And that's really all I have to say.
Tell them what flavor you vape.
The flavor that I vape was cinnamon. I wanted nothing to do with tobacco after smoking for 30 years. I'm open for questions if you guys have any questions.
Okay. Tim, we're going to go ahead and take James's testimony, and then we'll open up the whole panel. James?
Yes, sir. My name is James Wright. I'm the lab manager at VapeRight here in Salem itself, or actually in Kaiser. We're actually on the other end of the spectrum. We are a family-owned business. We just started a ramp up into web sales this month. And I have to say that the 190 is basically, I mean, the bill is 2 pages long. So it's basically kind of a prohibition, and any money that we had currently put into building our website, if the SB 190 passes, it would basically make it so, I mean, generally people will go overseas or to another state if they can't order it from Oregon. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, cause and effect. The internet is completely unregulated. I mean, we have age verification on our website, and I'm sure the EC has is on theirs. I mean, if a teen is going to get an e-cigarette and they're going to buy it online, they're either going to order it from China or they're going to click I'm 18 or older. I mean, it's just nature. I mean, there was a New York Times article back in 2012 when there was a study done about age verification and internet. And it basically says that companies do it because they know they have to do it. I could read it. I have it. And I don't know if you really want me to read it. It's a short paragraph. That they do it, but they know that it doesn't work, and that it should basically boil down to good parenting on, you know, don't go, this is, I don't want you to do that. Don't do that. It's good parenting and such like that with, you know, minors that are going to try and get them. I oppose the SB 190, unless the I would strongly recommend that the dash 2 be passed on it. And that's it.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher first.
So, I guess, is that the age verification? Just a check mark, kind of like what we have on our voter registration?
If I may, Senator, the only two countries that have actually gotten age verification to work are Germany and North Korea, because you actually have to sign in with your Social Security number or that variant there. I mean, it's every company that does it, there's no tracking, there's no actual way to, you know, you can do certain things to make it so, you know, you could be in Oregon, but it'll look like you're in North Carolina. So,
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, there are some states that have looked at ways to regulate the internet with like a third-party verification ID, where the FedEx driver is actually asking for ID. That's fairly expensive, but we would be available and interested in at least sitting down and having those discussions about how we could do that. But there are other options to discuss.
And EC Blend as a company has actually already checked into doing some of that. We were currently working with USPS to build a system to where at least the initial order would have to be a ID check. So currently, as with many vape shops, it's just to check the box. They have to set up their account. Basically, they're going to lie and say they're 18. And if we ever catch them at that, we should turn off their account.
I'm just wondering what they do with the wine. Don't they kind of, didn't we just recently do something like that, you know, allow for sales?
Yeah, I think
to
that's
the mail
signature.
With wine.
You
yeah.
have to have a signature on the
right.
Place of delivery.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? I've got a couple. Tim, EC Blends, is that retail or is that distributing or is it are you manufacturing and then distributing? Or?
We are a manufacturer of the e-liquid that goes okay. in the e-cigarettes, and we actually do both online. We have 4 brick-and-mortar stores in Oregon currently. We have online retail sales as well as wholesale sales.
Okay. And James, from what your description of your business, you said mom and pop, so is it basically it is, retail that's gone?
Yeah, it's me, my wife, and my father-in-law, okay. and that's it.
So you have a retail, and then you're now opening and expanding into online sales?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got another couple of people who want to testify. Will Cruz, or Cruz and Michael Jones. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill? Why don't you go ahead and come up, sir? Gentlemen, whoever would like to go first.
Senator Przanski, committee, my name is Will Krause. I come to you actually in a dual capacity. I am owner of Northwest Vapors, which is the second largest e-liquid manufacturer in the state of Oregon. And we also source the hardware products from China and sell those both wholesale and retail. But I also come to you as president of the Northwest Vapor Association. We are a group of manufacturers and retailers throughout the state of Oregon. We represented a number of jobs within the state. First, let me say that as an organization, we are all committed to not selling our products to people under 18, and we do everything we reasonably can to prevent that. In fact, some of our stores won't even allow underage people to enter the store. Understand there are 2 different types of purchasers of our products. There are those people who want to get the least expensive product they can, and those are typically internet purchasers. Then there are those who want more immediate gratification in terms of spending their money and having something, who want to have a personal interaction, and those people buy from the retail establishments. as my business, we sell to both types of customers. And depending on the month, it's anywhere from 40 to 60% of our sales are via the internet, and the rest of them are through our wholesale accounts, both here in Oregon and throughout the rest of the United States. For our internet sales, the only age verification that has proved in any way effective, and it's not totally effective, has been the fact that you require a credit card for purchase, because you have to be 18 years of age in order to get a credit card. The problem is any kid can grab mom or dad's credit card and go to the internet, but then they have to use their mom or dad's name in order to purchase, because it has to match the billing statement. So deception is going to happen on the internet, and there's really no way you can stop that, because if it's ordered in the name of the parent, it's going to be delivered in the name of the parent, and even age verification on delivery won't stop that. So, it has been shown numerous times that using the credit card as an age verification eliminates most of the instances of sales to minors. My other big concern, two others. One is that if this prohibits us from selling to Oregon residents through our website, it's not really going to stop those people who are selling through their Amazon sites, people who are selling through their Facebook pages, people who are selling through their Yahoo accounts. These are people who are not registered businesses. They don't have the same business principles that the rest of us do. They just want to make some money, and they don't care who they sell it to. So this is not going to prohibit them from selling to kids under 18. In fact, it's in many cases going to drive underage people to purchase from these less reputable sources. The final thing is, if this law does pass as it is and we're required to identify all of our purchasers as being an Oregon resident, that means before we make the sale. In other words, we can't wait until they order something and then check their address because we've already collected money from them. We're going to have to make modifications to our website that would be fairly costly to identify the customer before they make the sale that they're an Oregon resident. Because, in fact, this would not make it illegal for an Oregon resident to look at our website and check out prices and things only to make the purchase. So it would have to be in the purchasing side of it. So that would increase our costs, reduce our profits, I see that as an unreasonable thing to do. Finally, we as an association have been working with a number of pieces of legislation and with legislators on both ends of the building here to make a distinction between tobacco products, electronic cigarette products or vaping products, and THC or marijuana-based products. Each of those three needs to be dealt with separately because of the uniqueness of the products, and therefore we would urge if this bill goes through, the use of the Dash 2 amendment, the approval of the Dash 2 amendment, to remove electronic cigarettes in this bill.
Okay.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. If you'll hold your seat, let's go ahead and get the testimony from the others, and we'll open up for questions.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Michael Jones. I'm with Rockin' Vape in Albany, and hope everyone had enough sleep. You know, everything that Will just said, kind of what I was going to tap on. But, you know, my personal story, I was just thinking back, you know, 4 years ago or 5 years ago when I started using vape and making that switch, I started on YouTube. I mean, I literally started looking around on YouTube. And at that point, when I finally found an online company, there was a lot. There was like hundreds that were just not able to take my payment without a PayPal. And I was just thinking back on that. I finally found a site that looked, you know, like they actually cared. And I kind of, when I made my business, I started the business after my mom died from smoking. And when I put the business in, we had 18 and over all the time. I mean, in our policies, it was just to have the Visa logo on our website, we had to have a lot of different policy structure up there. With Visa Verified, it actually does do a structure where it actually checks a bank account. I know they're improving that system, and I know they have been improving it for about 4 years now. So that there is a system in place for 18 and over. You do have to pay a little bit of extra money to be on Visa Verified to be an authorized vendor of that. But I know we're on it. I know it's still not going to take away from the kid stealing his parents' car. That's just going to happen. There's nothing we can do about it. But the in-store transaction, one thing that I had is I had another person come into my place, and he told me he was going to start his own business, and he asked me what the competition was. And, you know, and he said, is it the Voos? Is it the little e-cigs that you see in the 7-Elevens from the big tobacco companies? And I said, no. You know, it's the underage kid on Facebook selling the e-juice to his friends. You know, that's the hardest thing to get away from. You know, there are people out there that just have bad demeanor in everything in business that we're trying to do. So I think it's really hard when I pay my taxes, when I make sure that I have policies in place for 18 and over, when I double check everything and want to be a reputable business, and then I look back and there's somebody else out there that doesn't have to, and we're going to get this 190 passed, where it's actually going to hurt me, but not them. And I think about that, and I think about my employees, and I think about how, you know, trying to keep my business, you know, as a business, you know, instead of going into a black market. And I worry about that because we already have a huge black market out there, and that's being cleaned up as we speak. So the industry is being cleaned up quite a bit since when I first started this, and I love the way we're going. I'm very concerned about these bills.
Okay.
That's all I got.
Thank you.
Gentlemen,
if y'all identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Taylor Jones.
Okay.
I'm the lab manager and a partner at Vape Game. We're a e-cigarette or e-liquid manufacturer in Eugene, Oregon. A quarter of our gross sales are from over the phone, over the internet wholesale sales. Another 10% are internet sales. We put a lot of money into, we've built a national product. We ship our e-liquids being sold in stores all the way from Brooklyn, all the way to from Brooklyn to San Diego. A little over 10% of our sales are done on the internet. And what would happen if we were not able to have our website up, that we put a lot of money into building a reputation and a brand nationally, what would happen is other stores in the country would be selling to the customers that wanted to order online, whether it was Miners or not. Our own website, like these gentlemen have said, is set up where you have to, if you sign up and register, we won't ship to a different address than what is on the billing address. Some websites you can use a credit card with a billing address and have it shipped to a totally different name and address. Ours is not set up like that, and we felt like that was important to stop sales from going to identity theft or Miners. These guys covered everything else I needed to say. I digress.
Okay. All right, we'll just hang on there. Let's see. Any questions? Okay, I guess I had one question, and that was basically a suggestion, or let's say just a comment that's been made here from the dais, was maybe having some type of verification required at the time of delivery. Could either or any of you kind of give us your perspective on that as to when would it work, to what would be the expense or whatever, et cetera?
From what we've looked into it, the cost of the age verification delivery is about $6 per order. And when our average orders are anywhere from $30 to $40 per order, that's a significant increased cost for us, and we're already in a very price competitive market. And incidentally, Strawberry Fields is
Strawberry
flavor.
All righty. I was going to make anyone come clean on this.
this fee can be offset or externalized onto the customer, but then that just takes away our competitiveness.
Right.
We can no longer be competitive when the other sites can offer free shipping. We are absorbing another, and doubling or more than doubling our shipping costs per transaction.
Right.
If we had to compete with free shipping, and then if we're not providing free shipping, it's nullifies our ability to make sales. Anyways,
I like the idea. I like the idea of it.
Okay. Well, I had one other question. When you're identifying the type of business y'all have, you have internet sales and wholesale. Do you also have retail? And
yes. Yes, we have a retail shop in
okay.
the state.
We have three retail locations, Bend, Portland, and Eugene, or Springfield, Oregon retail locations.
And you're putting one in Eugene, correct?
No. No. Okay. Just our manufacturing facilities in Eugene.
Okay. Any other questions? Gentlemen, again, thank you all very much for coming
Thank you
forward.
Very much.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 190? Yes, sir. Come on up.
Thank you for hearing me. I wasn't going to speak this morning.
All righty.
I'm a little closer to home. My name's Ernie, and we have two retail stores here in Salem, one north, one out south, right across from Dutch
Ernie,
Brothers.
Ernie, would you give us the last name just for the record?
Morera, Morreira.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, just a little history. Young man, about 30 years old, came to me, was smoking a pack of half a day about almost 2 years ago. And he went from smoking to vaping overnight, felt great, wanted to open a store, didn't have a job, was on welfare. But he had a lot of fire. And so I was a small investor in that. And we opened the first store, opened the second store last September. We have five employees now, three of them young men, and me and another old guy. Anyway, It's just my thought on this. I'm a little nervous. I'm sorry. I don't usually speak in front of crowds. So
it's all right.
My thought is, it seems like there's a real wave against this vaping thing, and it's helping a lot of people get off of smoking. It's unbelievable to me. You know, you're freeing up the pot industry, and there's all this, you know. We all know that vaping's better for you. I mean, it's even the doctors that are a little bit opposing it come out at the end and say, you know, we know that vaping is better, way better than smoking. So anyway, I just wanted to share that we're right here in town, provided a few jobs. That young man is now a part owner of this business, and he's making he's off welfare, and he's making $40,000 a year. So it's... you know, and we have, that's what I want to say, is from day one, we've had a sign on our counter that says you got to be 18 or over to buy our product. So, and I'm just brick and mortar. We have done some online stuff, haven't been very successful with it, but you know, it's a large part of the industry.
Right.
So, anyway, that's it.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair. I want to point out that there is... on the vaping issue, there's a relatively comprehensive bill coming over from the House on that subject, so that may be the appropriate venue for some of those discussions.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for the comment. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. As counsel said, we can't work the bill even if we wanted to work the bill. I do believe, as Senator Cruz says, there is other legislation that's in the works, and it's to me, before we move anything, we need to make certain we know what else is on the table. So with that, we won't be having a work session on 190 at this point. And what I'm going to go ahead and do is open up. I'm going to jump down because right now on Senate Bill 381, I don't have anyone signed up. I'm assuming someone from the bar may be here. But I do have a list of people who are here on Senate Bill 462. And so we are going to open a public hearing on 462.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 462 deals with Article 9 of the UCC. It clarifies that the record of a mortgage is effective as a financing statement if the name of the debtor on the record of mortgage is the surname and first personal name of the debtor, even if the financing statement uses the name of the person as listed on a current driver's license or identification card. We have no fiscal and no revenue. This bill is ready to move, should you choose to do so.
All right, thank you. So I'm going to first call up Tim Martinez and Steve. Cannot read the last name. Torgensen, maybe? You'll correct me when you get up here, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I want to thank you for not only introducing this bill, but also having this hearing today. I'm joined by Steve Turgeson, who is the Executive Vice President and Chief Lending Officer with Citizens Bank. Excuse me. Steve is here to kind of give you the on-the-ground benefit of what we're proposing today. I'll make a couple of brief comments, if that's okay, Mr. Chair, and then turn it over to Mr. Turgeson. For those of you that don't know, Article 9 was rewritten last in 2010. Prior to that, the last name was generally used to do a search. You did not even include the first name. It's my understanding that your home state, Texas, which, by the way, has more UCC filings than any other state, that probably doesn't surprise you, but they passed a non-uniform amendment similar to Alternative B years ago, and when the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, or NACUSL, decided to take up this issue, they looked at the Texas law. NACUSL and the American Law Institute were unable to reach any agreement on the issue of the way individual debtors should be identified in UCC financing statement. The name requirement for corporations or LLCs has been clear for a while. That filing must be the name that you filed with the state. So whatever you filed as your corporate name, that's what's used in making these loans and that filing. Because Nacuzel and the American Law Institute could not reach agreement on how to, what way to list individuals' names, they gave two options to states, what's commonly known as Alternative A and Alternative B. In a nutshell, Alternative A basically is a driver's license or a state-issued identity card. B is kind of a, I hope it's not improper to say, but kind of a, since I love Chinese food, it's kind of like going to a Chinese restaurant. You have all these different options. Oregon became one of the first states to adopt the UCC 9 update in 2012 and chose Alternative B upon the recommendation of the Oregon Law Commission. The chair of the Judiciary Committee, who if Senator Cruz and Senator Thatcher look to their right, and if Senator Burdick and Senator Gelser look to their left, you'll see who the chair of the committee was at that particular time, Senator Przanski. In the course of the hearing on that alternative A and B, Senator Przanski said that, you know, we would go with B, and please correct me, I know you will if I misstate, but basically said he wanted to see what other states did and see if there was a need to look at alternative A down the road. Very quickly, it became clear that alternative A was being adopted by states much more readily than B. For example, every state around us, Washington, Idaho, Nevada, have all chosen option A, which is what's in the bill before you today. Our neighbor to the north, Washington, initially chose B, I think partly because they wanted to be in line with us, but they changed to A within 2 years, thinking that A was a better option. As we sit here in March of 2015, 42 states, plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, have chosen A, with only 7 states going B. If you like stats, let me present it another way. There's approximately 312 million people, or excuse me, 316 million people in the United States. So far, states with populations of approximately 312 million have passed the Article 9 amendments. And 95% of those, or 296 million, have adopted A. So whether you go by population or number of states, alternative A seems to be the overwhelming majority approach. You should also know that the only state that as of yet has not adopted A or B is Oklahoma. And I just found out late last week that the Oklahoma House has adopted A unanimously. So we expect, and I don't want to speak for Oklahoma, but we expect that A will be adopted in Oklahoma as well. A couple of final points. Secured parties really want to avoid disputes with other secured parties by making sure that everyone's security interest with respect to a particular debtor can easily be ascertained so that no one will extend credit based on a lack of knowledge about another secured party's position, and we believe alternative A is that better option. Not only large national banks, but regional banks such as Umpqua Bank operate in multiple states and many transactions over those multiple states. A uniform standard between the states will significantly improve efficiency in processing loan transactions and minimize the possibility of mistakes. Lastly, I will say, as I mentioned earlier, Nacuzel gave the states two options. Presumably because they weren't able to determine which one they felt would be the option of choice. It seems to us that when you have our entire Northwest region going one way, and again, 44 jurisdictions, soon to be 45, going to alternative A, it makes sense that since this is supposed to be a uniform law, that Oregon join with those other jurisdictions. I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions before Mr. Turgeson makes his remark. And I will just say one last thing. I began with Texas as one of the initial reasons Nacuzel looked at this. Let me just tell you that Texas also went with alternative A. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and morning. Senators, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak on this issue. I'm in favor of alternative A and for several reasons.
Steve, I need you to put your name on the record, please.
Okay. My name is Steve Turgeson,
thank you.
T-E-R-J-E-S-O-N. I'm with Citizens Bank in Corvallis, Oregon. This is, I believe, is a commercial and agricultural issue, not as much a consumer issue. Consumer loans are secured by titles, whether it's a vehicle or an RV or a boat, or real property, or purchase money. So very few, and I don't believe I've ever seen a UCC filing for a consumer. So this is primarily commercial and agriculture. Our bank is a community bank, and our niche is consumer and agriculture, or commercial and agriculture, from Tualatin down to Springfield, primarily the Willamette Valley. One of the reasons for alternative A is to get the confusion out and make it straightforward. Right now, a corporation, we can get the articles of incorporation, get the legal name, and we're good to go. LLCs or other business entities, we can get their operating agreement, get their legal name, and we're good to go. Using the license of an individual would be the document that we could use to get their legal name, and then there's no confusion. We deal with a lot of farmers who have multiple generations and in some cases similar names. And I'm not going to use it, but for example, Robert Grant, Robert Grant Jr., and Robert Grant III. There are people like that. And if we were lending to Robert Grant III and we pulled a UCC search, we could find Robert Grant. But that tells us nothing, because we don't know which one of the Robert Grants it is. We can call the bank, and they can confirm, yes, this loan's to Robert Grant. But still, we don't know if it's the third or junior or senior. So we have one of three choices. One, we could decline the loan. We could take additional collateral, which usually is what we do. We take real property or title property that we know we have a perfected interest in. Or take the risk and file with the legal name that we use and battle that out in court. So to simplify and make it very crystal clear on who the borrower is and to perfect your security interest in the collateral, alternative A is the best use. I believe I'll stop there.
All right, Steve, thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
So what would happen with all the old UCC filings, Robert Grant Jr., Robert Grant III, whatever? You would still be in the same boat, right? And wouldn't you now be able to just take their driver's license? Don't you just take your driver's license information now anyway?
We do as our bank, but not all banks do, because we're an alternate B. You could take the name of whoever's on the application. So to phase alternate A in, it will take some time, and we're going to have to do what we're doing today for 3 to 5 years or whatever that phase-in period. But once we get through that, then it's very clear. You take the name on the driver's license, and that's the borrower. And that's your perfected interest.
Okay, thank you. I was just trying to clarify that what the issue is. So you're saying that some banks might say Robert Grant III, because that's what he put down on the application, yet another bank will take the name right off the driver's license, which might say Robert Grant Jr. on it. Yeah. And you're not sure if it's the same person or if it's just a family member. And because of that, you may reject the loan or take their word for it that it's not them, it's a relative.
Correct.
And ends up possibly being them, and you're overextending them or something. Has this happened?
Well, I don't know that we'd overextend them, but we might take additional collateral to protect ourselves.
I see.
And that has happened.
Okay. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
All right, I have at this point three other individuals that are signed up: Lane Shutterly, Walter Goel, and then Art Towers.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll go first, I guess, if I may. Lane Shutterly, I'm a practicing attorney over in Dallas. I should mention that Peter Threlkeld just came in the room. Peter manages the UCC filing system for the Secretary of State's office. If any of you have any questions about the technical aspects of this bill, he'll be a useful resource to you. Let me just paint, first of all, just so you know where I'm coming from on this, I actually have two hats, well, three. One is as a member of the Uniform Law Commission from Oregon, so in that respect, I'm agnostic on this bill because Alternative A and Alternative B are both part of the Uniform Act. It doesn't matter to me from that perspective which Oregon adopts. I'm also chair of the Oregon Law Commission. It was an Oregon Law Commission work group, as you heard from Tim Martinez, that actually evaluated these alternatives back in 2012 when we first introduced these Article 9 amendments. And that work group recommended and the Law Commission adopted the recommendation to present option or Alternative B to the legislature. So wearing that hat, I'm very much an advocate for Alternative B. And also as a private attorney just in downtown Dallas, representing clients, not banks, but clients who in their business transactions are involved in Article 9 security filings, I also favor Alternative B. Let me set, if I may, just a transactional structure here so you understand really how this works, because this is awfully esoteric stuff. And this is in a non-bank transaction. You have a business owner in Dallas who's owned the auto parts store for his career in business and wants to retire and settle somewhere south, perhaps, you know, it's so typically in a small business situation, you've got a buyer who doesn't have cash, is not going to be able to pay you off, and so these sales are often sales over terms. That's on contract with so much money down, and then the balance paid over 5 years or 10 years, counting on the business to provide the income to pay the debt and finish the purchase. So in that scenario, what happens is the seller of the business takes the money, enters into a contract, and they take a security interest in the inventory and stock and all the cash and accounts. Basically, they take a security interest in the business. So if the buyer of the business defaults, then the seller has the ability, unhappily, to come back from wherever they may be in retirement and repossess the business if they have to and take it back over and build it up again so they can sell it again. That's the risk of being a small business person. So they take a security interest in all this inventory, product, and goods. But in order to make sure that they're perfected in that so that they're in first position as a security interest, they file a financing statement with the under the Uniform Commercial Code with the Secretary of State's office. And that's the document we're talking about today. It's that financing statement that gets filed at the Secretary of State's office that says, I have a security interest in these goods. These are not banks. These are not people who are trained. They don't do this every day. This may be a once-in-a-lifetime transaction, but it also may be that person's entire nest egg that he is trying to protect here. And so knows this purchaser is John Davis. They might have known each other for years in a small community. That happens. I know who John is, so I take the security interest, enter into the contract, file it under John Davis, and then I, as the business owner, go south and enjoy my retirement. Now, John, who is running the business, needs an operating line of to actually provide cash. So he goes to the bank and negotiates a loan with the bank to provide cash. The bank wants a security interest as well. And so the bank is going to look at whether or not there is a security interest already, because if there is a prior security interest, as you heard already, probably the bank is going to want other collateral to protect themselves, because having a second place security interest is not that valuable in a small business in particular. So the bank will do the search. Currently, under Oregon's system of searching, which is a very robust system, if you enter John Davis, you're going to come up with John D. Davis, John L. Davis. You'll find all sorts of John Davises, and that puts you on notice to inquire further as to which John Davis you have here and whether or not you have that perfected security interest. The risk that we have in this bill is that the seller of the business, who was unsophisticated and maybe filed this on his own, they often do, and it's after that that they come to see me, and doesn't know the intricacies of Article 9, they've filed under the name that they know this fellow by, might have known him for years. In coming on later, a bank or another secured party coming in looks at the driver's license, sees the particular name by which this person has is on the driver's license, says, well, there's no valid prior security interest because none of the prior security interests here are in the debtor's name as it appears in the driver's license. Yeehaw, we're in first position. We'll go ahead and make the loan. If that buyer of the business then defaults, all of a sudden, when the seller of the business comes back to enforce a security interest, he discovers that he's not in first position anymore. The bank has stepped in front of him because the bank got the name by the driver's license, and the seller of the business just happened to sell a file under that person's common name, but not that name exactly as it appears on the driver's license. And that is the situation that we're concerned about, where your unsophisticated, only occasional, maybe once-in-a-lifetime filer may not know the rules as well as the bank does, and thereby put themselves at risk of losing that security interest, which represents their nest egg. That was the policy consideration, probably more than anything else, that led the Law Commission to recommend Option B. Option B doesn't disadvantage the bank. If the bank wants to use the driver's license, as Senator Thatcher noted, it can use the driver's license, and it will be fully protected any time it files a security interest. What it does, what Option B does, Alternative B, is it makes the target bigger so that you don't have to be the marksman, the sharpshooter, in order to hit that target on the financing statement to know that you're perfected. That was the policy consideration that the Law Commission favored in 2012. You'll see from the materials you have, it is also the position of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, lawyers that represent clients who practice in this area on a daily basis, both, I'm sure, bank and non-bank clients. And you have other testimony here today, also a letter from Mark Comstock, an attorney in Salem who also represents debtors and creditors, all looking at this from the policy perspective of favoring that broader target in order to be able to perfect that security interest. Just a couple of things, and I'll finish up, but I want to point out. We were aware in 2012 that the American Bankers Association strongly favored Alternative A, the smaller target. And we knew even then that our Alternative A would probably be the majority choice by most states. We didn't know the numbers. And in fairness, Senator Brzezinski said then that he was curious to see where the numbers broke down over time as more states adopted these amendments to the UCC, Article 9. And the numbers did break, as you heard from Tim. So last September, we took this back to the Oregon Law Commission, knowing now what the numbers are, and said, folks, this is how the country has gone relative to Alternative A and B. We'd like to have you reconsider your Alternative B option in light of those numbers. The Law Commission took a look at it. We heard from the Bankers Association in a hearing last September, and after hearing that, the Law Commission reaffirmed on a policy basis its support for Alternative B, even knowing where the numbers were across the country. So this isn't just a matter of numbers. It is a matter of policy. The other thing that I would say that for the banks, Alternative A does not make it so simple for the banks as you might believe from what you've heard. Senator Thatcher asked about, well, what about this transition period where you have these different varieties of names? You're still going to have to search under those varieties. That is correct. And even after that time of transition has run out under this bill, banks are still going to have to search under a broader array of names because you have things like tax liens filed at the Secretary of State's office that any bank or any lender is also going to want to know about if they're considering taking a security interest in property, and tax liens don't follow the Article 9 rules, the naming rules. They're not subject to Article 9, and so they're going to be under, again, a wider variety of name types, and not just the driver's license name. And so banks, even if they're coming from an Alternative A state, they are still going to have to look at the broader variety of that debtor's names. So it's not as straightforward a search issue as it may sound. Again, our concern from a policy perspective is that narrowing the target for what it takes to perfect that security interest is going to disadvantage your occasional, sometimes once-in-a-lifetime filer who's working on their own in this very complex area of the law. We want to give them that broader target that protects them better and does not disadvantage them in favor of those sophisticated filers who are more likely to know the rules and may step in front of them in a security interest. I'll stop at that. I want to give time for my friends here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Walter Gowell. I'm a local attorney from McMinnville. I've been involved in Article 9 revisions since the first Article 9 task force and served on the Law Commission with Mr. Shetterly. I would like to say that Article B was chosen by the Law Commission because it provided a safe harbor. It provided certainty as to one name you could use that would always be known to be sufficient. And that made it more user-friendly, not less user-friendly than the pre-existing system. Alternative A does just the opposite. It basically says you may only use the name that's only on the driver's license, and if you don't use that name, then if you use any other name, regardless of how understandable or how accurate it is, then a subsequent security interest holder can jump in front of you in terms of priority. And this is very threatening from the standpoint of small user transactions. One of the problems that we discussed at length in the Law Commission was the fact that if you are a large institutional user, you can have an account at the DMV that allows you to go online to look up and verify this name that's on the driver's license. As a small user, you can't do that. There is no online, because of our privacy laws that protect the identities of driver's license name holders, it is not possible for you or me, without an account, without being in the business, to go online and make that kind of search, even if you knew to do it, which many unsophisticated filers don't. So that's a practical problem. That problem may get solved down the road in future years as information becomes more accessible and we work out the balance between privacy and accessibility. But today, that is still a problem, and that was identified by the Law Commission and played a role in the recommendation. The third point I'd like to make is that the argument that's been made here is that uniformity and certainty are the primary criteria here. The Law Commission looked at that very seriously because it is important to have systems that integrate with other states. However, along the way, you don't want to lose the concept of equity. And when the small person who doesn't have the same electronic access to DMV records or the same knowledge and experience of credit laws and procedures is basically told this system is going to be made less user-friendly to you and you're going to be more at risk, then that is, from a policy standpoint, maybe not the direction to go. And it was not the direction that the Commission desired the legislature to go, and the legislature adopted that recommendation, and this is the third attempt to reverse that, and I'm sure not the last. But I ask that the committee focus on the policy issue, not the simple uniformity and certainty issue. The last thing I wanted to say is, in looking at my own wallet, I had two credit cards, a debit card and a Sears card that identify me as Walter R. Gowell. I have a Home Depot card that identifies me as Walt R. Gowell. I have a Providence Medical card and a Costco card where I'm Walter Gowell. And I have one card in my wallet, my driver's license, that says I'm Walter Raymond Gowell, a name I don't normally go by. However, that is my full name, and it's on my driver's license. An extended search at the UCC office under any of those names would turn up all of those names under the current system. And I think maybe the most telling testimony I've heard was in response to Senator Thatcher's question, have you had this occur, this mistaken identity? And the answer was, well, no. The answer was not no. The answer was not yes. There was no affirmative response to has this occurred. No, but we've been uncertain and had to and get more collateral. That certainly is the case. But my main concern is that this is a solution in search of a problem. And from the standpoint of smaller agricultural, small business, and unsophisticated users of the system, this creates an unacceptable risk of loss of priority. When you lose priority, you lose whatever security you had, and that's a real shame. Finally, I want to make one comment, and that is that once upon a time there was a disaster in the grass seed industry in this state. As I recall, Senator Cruz was involved in having a task force look at the agricultural laws of this state and revise those statutory liens to make them more important. And the keystone of that was priority of those statutory liens over the security interests, the priority of security interests. In revised Article 9, just about every state defined the term agricultural lien in a way that would have reversed the priority of that Oregon tradition of allowing agricultural interests to perfect and to have priority over pre-existing security interests. However, in Article 9, the term agricultural lien in Oregon defines agricultural lien to exclude all three of the statutory liens that Oregon uses to protect farmers. That is probably maybe one or two states that do that. But it's done for a very important reason, and that is to preserve the longstanding policy that the legislature has had to give people in the agricultural sector protection against prior perfected security interest holders. And so I say to you in that regard that being different is not always being wrong. And I encourage consideration of the opposition to this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Art?
Hello. For the record, my name's Art. I'm Arthur Lewis Towers, on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And others have spoke more eloquently in the opposition to this bill than I can. We're also opposed mainly out of for many of the reasons that were mentioned earlier on, but also this is a subject area where there can be real unintended consequences. And so we just recommend a go-slow approach on this topic. So, again, I'll defer to the other folks and I'll leave it there. Happy to answer questions.
All right, questions. Senator Burdick first.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Lane, in these transactions where the security is, where the financing is obtained, isn't there a notary involved at some stage of the game on signing these forms?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, not necessarily. A contract of sale of a business doesn't require a notary, and a financing statement does also not require a notary. So there may not be a notary involved. In fact, I would say commonly would not be.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my reason for asking the question is it seems to me that there should be some way, if we move to this system that other states are using around us, that there should be some way of informing people of what they have to provide, the correct identity they have to provide. And a notary would certainly be one way of doing that. If it were right there on the form, that the notary has to use the name of the license. It was just a thought, because it's hard for me to believe that other states would have done this when the consequences that you describe could be pretty serious, and it seems like we would have heard more horror stories.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, first of all, this is not an area that's likely to excite a lot of headlines. So, probably the stories you hear are going to be more in the in cases and being small commercial cases involving sales of business or security interest in collateral. You're not going to hear a lot about that. What I would say as to why other states have gone with option A, I think clearly the American Bankers Consumers Association, as I mentioned, is a strong advocate of option A. And frankly, you don't have something like the Oregon Law Commission in most other states that really looks at this as a policy question. I would say in most states, Article 9 amendments have come in as a Bankers Association bill from those respective states with alternative A built into it. There's no really organized group to speak for the occasional unsophisticated filers in most states, and so it's really not been a big choice. I wouldn't say that's the case in every state, but I think that's largely it. In Oregon, we do have, I think, the real benefit of the Oregon Law Commission to look at this, actually pull it apart and look at it as a policy question, and that was the policy decision that the commission made in 2012 and again reaffirmed last year. And again, having a different system here in Oregon on the debtor's name is not being so far out of uniformity that we are going to be left behind. Keep in mind that this is one piece of a very large Article 9 bill. And we're focusing here, and so I think it looks and sounds bigger because we're talking only about this. But we have adopted a uniform act, and we've made a choice that was provided by the Uniform Law Commission to give states the purpose, purposely, the ability to make that policy choice. We did it, and I think it was the correct policy choice, and I would encourage the Senate committee to reaffirm that.
Senator Thatcher first, and then Senator Cruz.
Thank you. There's a lot of mention of the unsophisticated person that might be involved in this transaction, and they're going through, they're drawing up a contract, but I guess what makes them take the next step to go to the Secretary of State's office to file a UCC? I don't think that would just be an automatic occurrence. You know, A, I'm going to go to the, you know, that's going to be the next step to an unsophisticated person. And I would think that there would be an attorney involved somewhere along the line, and the attorney would probably be advising as to what they should, what steps they should be properly taking.
Sure, I'll take a stab at that, and that anybody else, Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher. First of all, a business person might well know to do this because they've had business loans and they've gone through this process as the borrower. And so they have this sense that this is how the system works. It's not that uncommon. And I would like to think that they would have an attorney and the attorney would be advising them carefully on this issue as they go through. It is not uncommon for me to see these deals come into my office after the fact, after they have done it, the parties have done it, and it's gone sideways for one reason or another. So ideally, yes, they would have an attorney. Ideally, they would know. In many cases, they're going through it, the motions, because they know that's how it's done, but they're not doing it expertly, and in that the way, they're putting themselves at risk.
I would add to that, a lot of businesses that operate in the daily trade have credit managers. And credit managers typically know that they need to get a security interest if they want to have a form of collateral that's more than just an unsecured debt. And so it's not uncommon for small business people on their own, without the use of legal counsel, to sign security agreements. Sometimes their forms contain that. Then file financing statements. And they typically would do that based upon the names that are on the application or the names that they're familiar with if they know these people. And so it is, and most of them probably do not have an ongoing business account with the DMV. So they're not the sophisticated level that we would like to see, but they still feel comfortable about using the system that's been created to be accessible to them. And so the question is, how accessible do you want it to be? How user-friendly do you want it to be? Or how do you want to create this pitfall in the middle of the process at the very pivotal point of perfection? Because perfection is the key to priority. And if you lose perfection, you lose priority. And that is what this is all about.
I guess I would have a follow-up.
Sure.
So in these other states that have transitioned from the alternative B to alternative A, have there been problems? Can you cite
issues that have occurred?
I don't know that we know enough that in terms of studies to, I haven't seen any feedback. It's been relatively only a couple of years since most of these states have undertaken this process. What I can tell you just from experience is that in my 35 years of practice in the small business agricultural area in McMinnville, I have never once seen a battle over priority based upon the name and the identity of the debtor on the financing statement. That this, there is not a huge situation where you have numerous problems in Oregon over whether or not a name was sufficiently disclosed on a financing statement in order to enable other creditors to search adequately. So that I can tell you from personal experience.
All right, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, statement first. I just for the record, I think it's possible for a business person to make a sound and rational decision without the aid of a lawyer. I think I did that once myself, Mr. Chair. But because the ag lien piece was brought up, I want it on the record that this in no way impacts that, this bill.
No, it does not.
All right, I have one question, and I guess Walter, it goes to you. You've made in your responses in your presentation the need to potentially have access to the DMV records to do a check. I mean, if someone comes to, if I'm doing this transaction and I say I need to see your driver's license or your state ID card, is there a reason why we would not be able to rely on what's on that card as being what is filed with the DMV?
Well, the problem is the statute says the currently issued card, so that you would need to know, has that card been revoked? Is it current? Has it been updated or changed because somebody got divorced or got remarried or changed their name for one of a number of other reasons? So in order to be cautious and careful, you would need to do an online verification of that driver's license because it was issued in a point in the past. And so like a title company, you always want to know what is the situation today. And so that online verification piece is, I think, very critical.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Peter, you're here from Secretary of State's office. Why don't you come forward? I also had one question that she just wanted to pose.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I was just curious about whether the UCC filing and the DMV database could be made online to interact with each other so that if somebody was searching the UCC, whether that would be able to link somehow to what was currently put into the DMV database.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Peter Threlkale, Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State. That is a really good question. I know that our elections registration system does access a DMV file. I'd have to think if a member of the public is able to go to the election system and search for the voter record of any other system in Oregon or any other citizen or registered voter, I don't believe that they can, and that is a fundamental difference, if that's the case, with the UCC system. The UCC system is a public notice system. It's to allow any member of the public to search for a debtor and see if there are liens or filings against that named debtor. So, I would have to I'd have to do some research, and I could do that and get back to the committee to see if there's any possibility there.
Okay. Any other questions for Peter? Thank you very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 462? Not seeing anyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And there's been a couple of questions that have been raised, and so we're not going to do a work session today on 462. I guess what I'd like to know is what our schedule is for tomorrow, because, Susan, I know you're here on 381. Were you by yourself?
Yes.
Okay. So when are you scheduled to be back in the building?
I'm here on a daily basis.
3381 and 226 tomorrow.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is go ahead and carry over for tomorrow, and I need to just get my list here. Senate Bill 381, and...
226.
And we're carrying it over because we're looking at the... Yeah, and we'll carry over 226A, House Bill 226A, tomorrow. And 462, how much time do you think we need?
Do you want any amendments on that?
Are we made? We're going to set 462 for a work session. I need to check in with members. And so with that, we'll just go ahead and close. We already closed it, so I think we're done for today. Tomorrow, we're here at 8:30, if I'm not mistaken, so we're adjourned.
Very good.
Adjourned.
Very good.
Mistaken, so we're